Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. Health organizations estimate Mexico and many other countries in Central and South America have fatality rates much higher than the U.S., and indigenous people are among those disproportionately affected. There is much to be learned about how testing, tracking, and treatment is going to truly understand the full impact the COVID-19 pandemic is having on the country south of the U.S.-Mexico border. Join us after the news as we take a deeper look into this issue.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt signed legislation Tuesday known as Ida's Law to address unsolved cases of missing and murdered Native Americans. It's named after Ida Beard, a 29-year-old citizen of the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes who went missing in 2015. Relatives attended a signing ceremony in Oklahoma City. Ida's cousin, Lorenda Morgan, expressed gratitude. She spoke with KOCO 5 News.
A lot of Natives feel invisible, and that's how the family felt about Ida's case. And they felt that no one cared.
The bill directs the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation to coordinate with the U.S. Attorney's Office and Justice Department to obtain funding for a database. It also creates an office to work with tribal, state, and federal authorities on cases. According to state lawmakers, there are more than 220 missing American Indians in Oklahoma. Members of the Native community in the Minneapolis area were among those closely watching the trial of former police officer Derek Chauvin, who's been found guilty in the murder of George Floyd. Following Tuesday's verdict, there was celebration, relief, and discussion of moving forward on Twin Cities talk show Native Roots Radio. Minnesota's Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan from the White Earth Nation also expressed moving forward. In a statement on social media, she said, "It's a step towards justice and work's not done on public safety." Native community members have supported the Black Lives Matter movement since Floyd's death last May. Within days of Montana's first confirmed COVID-19 case, the Blackfeet Nation declared a state of emergency. 1 year later, Blackfeet Nation is one area leading the country in high vaccination rates. In part one of this two-part story, Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports on the techniques the tribe's using to get the vaccine to anyone who wants it.
Just watch the door when, that first step comes out, so.
Okay. A high wind keeps pushing over a heavy plywood sign reading, "Vaccine shots here," in a parking lot in St. Mary in the northwest corner of Montana. Beside the sign is the black RV the Blackfeet Tribal Health Department operates as their mobile clinic, taking COVID-19 vaccines from one remote town to the next. Inside is a group of first and second year nursing students from Blackfeet Community College, their instructor, and Brittany Racine, a registered nurse at the Tribal Health Improvement Program. Racine says walk-in vaccine appointments were open to everyone a month ago, at the same time they launched the mobile RV clinic.
Because a lot of the barriers to health, like barriers to getting the vaccine and stuff, is no transportation or finances.
This strategy is just one factor contributing to Blackfeet's high vaccination rate. Once the vaccine was available to any adult in mid-March, regardless of residency or tribal status, nurses say people traveled to their clinics from as far away as California, Idaho, and Seattle to get a shot. But others just happened to be in the area. Daniel Hines was replacing logs on older buildings in Glacier National Park.
The maintenance guy told me they happened to be in the parking lot and they were giving away shots. And I knew I could get an appointment, but it's right here, right now, so I said, what the heck?
Community protection started early in the pandemic, when Blackfeet Nation took proactive measures to minimize exposure to the coronavirus. A study published by the CDC in early April found stay-at-home orders and mask mandates put in place by the Blackfeet Tribal Business Council last fall resulted in a 33-fold reduction of COVID-19 cases on the reservation. Nurse Racine says unvaccinated locals are now just those who aren't ready to get it.
I think we've pretty much covered everyone that wants to get it. And I think the last 5%, they're gonna start slowly trickling in. And we received the Pfizer vaccine, so we'll be targeting our 16 and 17-year-olds now.
As of April 15th, Blackfeet COVID-19 Incident Command reported 7,900 people have been vaccinated, including over 95% of adult members of Blackfeet Nation. In Montana, for National Native News, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
This reminder to get your COVID-19 vaccination is provided by the Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who support this show. Info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homelands, Ashirwiktui. Mexico and some Central and South American countries are struggling with the COVID-19 pandemic much more than most of the rest of the world. Mexico's health department reports more than 211,000 deaths from the disease. But incorporating unreported deaths could bring the number closer more than 330,000 people. Among some indigenous communities, misinformation and mistrust are hampering vaccination efforts. Also, discussions among politicians in this country over the role detention centers and immigration facilities play in spreading COVID-19 is spreading and creating confusion over how to go forward. In this hour, we'll talk with community workers about how the pandemic has affected indigenous people so far and what vaccination efforts look like in the light of language barriers and immigration issues. You can join our conversation, too, by calling 1-800-996-2848. And are you concerned about how our Indigenous brothers and sisters south of the U.S.-Mexico border are faring, especially during the pandemic? And what should be done to include these communities in pandemic relief work? Our number to join us is also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we're going to start off in Chicago, Illinois. Joining us today on the line is Oscar Chacon, and he is a co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas. Oscar, thank you for joining us for another Native America Calling.
It is my pleasure. I appreciate the invitation, Tara.
And so, Oscar, tell me a little bit about what you have been observing when it comes to the way the pandemic is affecting indigenous communities south of the U.S.-Mexico border. What are some of the things you've witnessed?
Well, I mean, the first thing that I believe is important to say that just as it is the case in the United States of America, many people south of our border, particularly indigenous communities, Afro-descendants in the region, have historically been very much excluded from the little work that has been done by way of creating a solid social well-being base, particularly in the area of healthcare. So as a result, you know, what we have seen is a significant amount of impact on these particular communities, which I insist, I mean, have historically been excluded from essentially enjoying basic access to issues like healthcare. And so the impact, I mean, is compounded by the fact that there hasn't really been a well-coordinated response among different countries. Keep in mind that aside from Mexico, Central American countries are very centralized entities in the so-called central government. And so information doesn't flow as uniformly as you would expect. It is also important to point out that the leadership display that different leaders have had in relationship to COVID is very different. I mean, you have, frankly, cases in Mexico where the president of Mexico initially was very aligned with the point of view of President Trump in the U.S., essentially downplaying, you know, the dangers of the pandemic. And, you know, to some degree, I mean, that also gets to be repeated in other Central American countries, whereas in others, there has been a little more emphasis on prevention. But again, I mean, I think it's important to emphasize that, as I said before, just like the case in the U.S., if communities were already in a vulnerable situation even before COVID-19 surfaced, COVID-19 has only compounded. I mean, those conditions of exclusion that communities have endured, particularly by indigenous and African descent populations in this region.
And what about the role of politics in all of this within different communities? Are there some countries where politics, you feel, has suppressed taking a handle on the pandemic?
Yes, there is that as well. I mean, I think that the case that comes immediately to my mind as you ask the question is the case of Nicaragua, where the Nicaraguan government has been very into politicizing the response to COVID-19. What I mean by that is if you are aligned and close with the party in office now, you have been able to get access to prevention, access to vaccine to the extent that there is vaccination going on. But if you happen to be in the opposing camp to the current government, then your reality may be much more precarious. There is also politics in a different way. I mean, and it is simply that, you know, we have a situation where record keeping is not something that you can really count on. I mean, some of these countries are reporting numbers that most people look at them with great deal of skepticism just because they don't seem to match, you know, with what people are actually listening, people are seeing. I can tell you that I know folks, particularly in Nicaragua, who have died of COVID, whose deaths were reported as something else. But again, I mean, the reality has been different on a country-by-country basis, and I would insist that the most significant point of vulnerability is the fact that we are talking about communities that were already experiencing very severe cases of exclusion in as far as being part of whatever kind of healthcare systems were in place prior to the pandemic.
And so, Oscar, do you know about what some of the approaches have been? Have there been lockdowns? Have indigenous communities closed borders? Do you know about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to understand that the one thing, you know, that in retrospective I can say was probably good to do is that most of these governments actually closed entirely their borders, to the point that mobility in the region, which has always been fluid over the past 40 years, came to a halt. And, you know, some people, as a matter of fact, are pointing very clearly that nothing had really stopped the human flows, the migratory flows in this region in any recent period of time as COVID did. And some folks, you know, were basically crediting the fact that there was hardly any migration in this region as a result of Trump policies. But I can tell you for sure that Trump policies did not really result in halting the mobility of human beings. It was really these lockdowns that were implemented and kept in place for months. The only problem with the lockdowns is that, unlike the case it is in many rich nations, including the U.S., governments in this region, nations there, I mean, do not have the financial capability to issue relief programs that are intended to basically allow people to have income, to have access to the basic needs they need to survive. And so what we have seen over the past 12 months, it's a very rapid increase in poverty, a rapid increase in people having lost any source of income they had. Even formal jobs, you know, have been cut back very severely, affecting, again, populations that historically take the brunt when changes like these come into place. So that is the picture that we are dealing with. Frankly, it doesn't matter which country. Mexico itself, I mean, has lost over 2.5 million jobs over the past 12 months. And you can be assured that a lot of those jobs lost affected, again, indigenous communities, Afro-descendant communities, which I cannot insist more than I have already, but they have historically been left out.
And so let's move deeper into migration and where things currently stand now, new administration is in. What can you tell us about migration?
Well, the first thing to understand, as I mentioned before, you know, the pandemic reality, the response by governments by essentially closing borders did not do anything to fix long-standing challenges that populations in these countries have faced. Over the past 40 years, leaving your country in hope to make it into the U.S. and be able to get a job in the U.S. has become a survival mechanism, you know, for millions of people. So in face of the fact that that was not possible because borders were entirely closed and even militarized in many instances, what we have is a situation where pressure has been building up over the past, you know, year. So as we came to the end of 2020, we began to notice more people reaching points of desperation where they were absolutely willing to take even higher risk and basically packing whatever belongings they had and leave, you know, their countries and try to make it into the U.S. I also want to point out that a lot of people got stuck in Mexico over the past 12 months because Mexico itself also had a significant restriction on mobility. And a lot of Central Americans from particularly Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador were literally stuck in Mexico, tens of thousands of them at the U.S.-Mexico border. So what we have had over the past 3 months and a half, it's a convergence of factors. You know, on one hand, the objective reasons, the very tangible conditions of life that have pushed people out happen to coincide with the fact that there is a new administration. A lot has been said, especially by anti-immigrant forces in the U.S., suggesting that it's Biden who's to be blamed for the fact that more people have been arriving to the border than in the past. But the reality is that the first 5-6 months of every year are always periods of times where more people tend to come into the U.S. in hope of basically crossing the border successfully. And as I said before, when you have had a pandemic that put everything on hold for a year, we should not have been at all surprised. Now, I do want to point out that there is a law in the U.S. Called Title 42.
And you know what, Oscar, you got to hold on that one. I want you to pick up right after the break. But you can join us too. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. Any thoughts on any of this? Dial in. Watching land disappear, change, or be destroyed weighs heavy on many indigenous people whose cultures and identities are very closely connected to the land. Ecological grief can have lasting impacts on Native communities. We'll talk about how ecological grief affects identity and community strength on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Mesota Pueblo, and today we're talking about how COVID-19 is affecting Indigenous people south of the U.S.-Mexico border. Join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848, and maybe you have some thoughts about all this. We would like to hear from you, 1-800-996-2848 or 1-800-99-NATIVE. With us today out of Chicago, Illinois, is Oscar Chacon, and he is the co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas, and our pleasure to have him here. Oscar, you were about to tell us more perspective and legislation in the U.S. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I was about to point out is that even in the middle of last year, the Trump administration invoked something called Title 42. Which is basically a public health and welfare law passed back in 1944 that essentially says that if the U.S. government suspects that there is a threat, a health threat, that could be coming into the country as a result of people migrating into the U.S., bringing literally illness, that the U.S. has the right to basically deny entry to those people altogether, using as a justification this Title 42. Now, when the Trump administration invoked this particular law, there was no evidence that the people who were attempting to come into the U.S. represented a health risk in any way, shape, or form. It was simply used to advance, you know, what was always a very important priority for the Trump administration. And that's how they kept almost anybody from entering into the U.S., coming through the U.S. southern border, particularly people from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, but also Mexico. And so what we have seen over the past few months is that upon the arrival of the Biden administration, you know, many people, including myself, expected that Title 42 was going to be basically released because there is no evidence to really justify invoking this particular law. But, you know, contrary to many of our expectations, that particular title has been kept in place, that particular law has kept being used, and a lot of people are being sent back to Mexico and Central American countries using this particular justification, again, without having any solid base of evidence to suggest that these migrants are carriers of COVID-19 or anything along those lines. Again, that's not to say that everybody is healthy. You know, keep in mind that we are talking about people that are very much, as I said before, left out, you know, from healthcare access capacity in their own countries. But the fact remains, there is simply no body of evidence to suggest that we are in face of a health risk as a result of people coming seeking humanitarian protection in the U.S.
All right. Thank you for that, Oscar Chacon with Alianza Americas. If there's anything you'd like to share with him, give us a ring, 1-800-996-2848. Also here today, joining us out of El Paso, Texas, is Ruby Orozco Santos, and she is the organizational storyteller for La Semilla Food Center. It's our pleasure to have her with us. Ruby, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tara.
And so, Ruby, tell me a little bit about your work with Borderlands and what you are learning about the impact of COVID-19 on Indigenous populations.
Sure. La Semilla Food Center works at the regional level here in what we currently know as the Paso del Norte region, which encompasses Doña Ana County in New Mexico, El Paso County in Texas, and we're right along the border with Ciudad Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico. So we're really right at the front lines of the geopolitical boundary and also experiencing, you know, those pre-pandemic inequities and the context of state violence and border militarization, you know, for which there is ample resources and investment, while the community and the population is experiencing, you know, high rates of poverty. Most of the population in the region is Latina of Mexican background, a lot of immigrant communities here, and the La Semilla Food Center you know, works through the regional food system to increase equity and connection in the community. And over the last 10 years, cultivating relationships with small growers, backyard growers, schools, and community programs, intergenerational programs with families, and also policy level advocacy. So in the last fall, we held a couple of story gathering sessions to hear from folks across the region at all those different levels, you know, to find out how the pandemic was impacting our foodways here in the region, you know, and how people are relating to land, passing on food traditions and accessing food, whether they grow it or not. And, you know, the pre-pandemic inequities and barriers and challenges, such as water scarcity, you know, barriers to land access for communities, barriers to accessing even their own time, right, to learn, to learn how to work with the land from their families or from formal programs, lack of resources. And so all of those things. And then now in the context of COVID, you know, how has this pandemic disrupted further and built further upon those challenges, and at the same time, learning from them around the, you know, the sources of resilience and the strategies that folks are employing. So, for example, you know, the pandemic laid bare the vulnerabilities in the conventional food system, and so people realizing that over relying on that conventional food system put them at a disadvantage when with the shortages of foods, or if there was food to be found, it was very expensive. And then the risk of transmission by heading out, by going to the market, and especially for families with larger numbers of members in their families, you know, having food shortages, like only being allowed to buy one dozen eggs per visit, means you have to make multiple trips and increase your exposure risk each time. And also at the same time, the nimbleness of the local growers, whether they were low-income backyard growers or small farmers, who, because they know the community and are connected, were able to not only provide for themselves but share their bounty with their community, and and to know, you know, who are the vulnerable folks in the community, how can we deliver curbside to them right away, and a nimbleness that just the conventional system simply does not have, because it's not connected to community on the ground. So there another important thing that we heard from people is that, you know, the kind of disrupting the rush, or the hamster wheel of disruption, right? So people, especially in the early time of the pandemic last year, like really kind of taking that forced pause and looking up and questioning, you know, this capitalist system that requires constant production, and being, you know, having the experience of actually having time to be with their grandchildren at home and retaking up the backyard garden and teaching things to their children and grandchildren. So particularly for members of, you know, intergenerational households who had that opportunity to be around each other more, that's been a something that people say, you know, we don't know what's going to happen next, but we want to keep this certain, you know, these things. And so, you know, there's been a lot to learn.
And so, Ruby, this is something that, you know, happens in Indigenous communities, that these lifeways, these are things we've been doing since the beginning of time. And so I'm hearing from you, people are really seeing the importance of this, and maybe even seeing, you know, that this is a viable way to live. And with changing habits as well is something that falls into all of this. And so, for you, Ruby, are Indigenous peoples from, you know, different places on this side of the Western Hemisphere, south of the U.S.-Mexico border, is this something they're returning back to? What are you hearing? Tell me more.
Yes, you know, and for people connected here and to the land in the region, you know, whether they've been here for several generations or are more recent immigrants who have those traditions to draw from, you know, that oftentimes are undervalued traditions, they're the ones that are noticing, you know, for example, how climate change is impacting the changes in the crops. You know, when are they flowering? How is it changing when they ripen, when they bloom? You know, they're the ones that are experimenting each season to, you know, with drought-tolerant plants, a lot of those indigenous plants that are part of family traditions. And we're really seeing that that return and that valuing. And so part of our work here in the region is to make those connections clear for community, because oftentimes the dominant message is to leave all that stuff behind and take on this new system and these new ways of over-relying on these conventional harmful extractive systems, and so showing folks a mirror to say, look, this is we're already doing this. There's a lot of wisdom in these indigenous food ways, and it's a source of resilience that I don't want to romanticize because it's very difficult and there's a lot of challenges, you know. But at the same time, unfortunately, there's generations and generations of practice of resilience because of the continued, assault and violence on indigenous lifeways.
And we've heard, you know, similar things in our nations, in our communities, in our villages, in our pueblos. If there's anything you'd like to share, dial in now, 1-800-996-2848. And Ruby, being there in the El Paso area, anything else you are witnessing about impacts of COVID-19 on people who are migrating to the U.S.?
I think that something important I'd like to share is just simply that, you know, this whole distorted notion of what border security means, and, you know, such a disgusting amount of investment in, you know, militarization and walls and fancy helicopters and vehicles, when true border security would mean investing in community, you know, and restoring our relationships and our health and our land, you know, and welcoming, you know, relatives who are fleeing from the same, you know, violent capitalist policies that are impacting their homelands.
Indeed. Well, thank you for that. And Oscar Chacon is here with us and with the Alianza Americas. And Oscar, after hearing what Ruby has shared, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I mean, just reinforce. I mean, I think that the fact that it is important to keep in mind is that communities throughout what we refer to as Mesoamerica in Alianza Americas, meaning basically southern Mexico and the Central American countries, if there is one characteristic that distinguishes our communities, including, of course, indigenous and Afro-descendant communities, is resiliency. And I think that that's very important. I also want to highlight the fact that not everything has been changed, and this is, again, a statement of resiliency, in as far as the drive to try to make us all become consumers, basically, of the same things, and the fact that many of our communities, especially within indigenous peoples and Afro-descendants, of customs that we have had for many, many years, actually are proving to be very important in a moment like the one we've gone through over the past 12 months. And I'm referring to specifically even basic ways in which we cook what we eat, you know, and what we actually eat to be actually good, you know, for our bodies in as far as strengthening our capacity to resist when we face situations like the one we've been dealing with over the past 12 months, perfectly knowing that we have been largely left out, ignored, in as far as our basic rights when it comes to something like healthcare access. So, no, I mean, I mainly want to echo what's been said.
Thank you, Oscar. Also here, too, out of Denver, Colorado, is Renee M. Chacon, and she is a youth program coordinator at Spirit of the Sun and also co-founder of Women from the Mountain. And she is a Samadora in Danza Azteca. And she is Dene and Mexica. Our pleasure to have her here. Renee, thank you for being with us today here on Native America Calling.
Thank you. And thank you to the previous interviewees. They're amazing for their work and their representation.
Indeed. And Renee, a lot of good words have been said here. And we've got a couple of minutes before the break. Just anything you want to reflect on?
Honestly, disproportionately impacted communities, indigenous communities, and BIPOC communities, those of Afro descent, now, honestly, a lot of these spaces where the system isn't broken, it's working as designed to leave us out with lack of healthcare access, with lack of true representation and policymaking and understanding migration is a natural form of just a natural form of life, and understanding that indigenous communities, this entire continent, should be able to have that with their human rights and basic necessities met locally, nationally, and continent-wide. So I'm really grateful that it is highlighted that a lot of communities have been able to prove that, as usual, that invisible identity of resiliency that still maintains a lot of this. Our communities, especially locally, are not going to be the same after COVID. A lot of elders are gone. A lot of communities have wreaked havoc because of this pandemic, just trying to have access to health care. But there's also a lot of resiliency. I've seen my elders, particularly Shannon Francis, for a year now, five times a week, do food share for elders all around town, no contact delivery by any means necessary. And in Colorado, that is not an easy feat with the type of weather that we have, especially the extremes because of climate change. So I really am grateful for those that are able to maintain that resiliency from a system that is continuing to target in a predatory way. And I hope that this pandemic has been another catalyst to highlight how disproportionately impacted communities need to be able to show you where the systems are failing us to be able to even heal and thrive in the same way that the dominant narrative does.
Sure. A lot is truly being revealed, and we'll continue to get deeper into this. And you're also invited into this conversation when we think of Indigenous nations in different countries in Central and South America. What have you heard? What have you seen? What have you witnessed in terms of how much COVID-19 has impacted Indigenous communities, both in rural areas as well as urban centers? And what about people who have migrated to this country? What are some of the stories they're sharing with you? Share the thoughts right now. 1-800-996-2848 is a number to call us. And if you are from an Indigenous community out of Central or South America, we want to hear from you too. Phone lines are open.
As COVID-19 vaccines are becoming available, Americans are eager to learn more, but frustrated about where to find answers. That's why AARP is working to protect Americans 50+ by connecting you to the latest information. You can learn who's eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine in your state, when, where, and how to get it, and what you might want to discuss with your doctor at aarp.org/vaccineinfo. AARP supports this program.
Thanks for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, and we are focusing on how the pandemic is affecting Indigenous populations south of the U.S.-Mexico border, and also those who have connections to these places who are residing here in the U.S. And what would you like to share about all of this? Give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is a number. With us today on the line out of Denver, Colorado, is Renee M. Chacon, and she is a youth program coordinator at Spirit of the Sun and also co-founder of Women from the Mountain, and she is a Samadora in Danza Azteca. She is Diné and Mexica. And thank you for being with us today here, Renee. And when we think about access to healthcare, there's a lot of things that go with that. And in terms of what's going on with vaccine efforts, what can you tell us and maybe any efforts you're involved in?
It's a lot of lack of access to basic necessities for disproportionate communities locally. I work in environmental justice definition and understanding what it really is for disproportionate communities, and it's in every sector. COVID has wreaked havoc in even education sectors, how kids are being able to access their education or not access their education. There's a digital divide. There's also a lot of grandparents and parents that are at home now. They're trying to help navigate, if they haven't already, this whole year of how to keep their children and their loved ones up to some type of standard of education locally so that they can continue through this. And then it's also healthcare. I live in Commerce City, so not only do we have COVID, but we have severe forms of particulate pollution from Suncor and a number of extractive industries. So it's those asthma visits. It's those constant anemia visits. It's the constant visits and need just before we get to the vaccine. And then it's the exposures just to go to those visits. And then hopefully it's access to testing, it's access to vaccine. So it's understanding where disproportionate communities need a lot of the bridges met and where they haven't been for a number of years and for a number of generations. And there are still some places here in even Commerce City that are still, instead of digital, they're using paper, or their lack of communication might not even be for bilingual or just first generation speakers here. And really understanding what it is to be more inclusive of disproportionately impacted communities. Also, there's other immigrant communities here in Colorado overall that we need to be mindful of, again, to translate these services for vaccines so that, again, it's not always just for the dominant narrative. So it's how we're trying to include and, again, dismantle forms of cultural erasure that we're not identifying the cultures there, indigenous, local, and Chicano, Mexicano, and mixed populations, and seeing where we can honestly go to those spaces. Adams County, where I was living, has the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but it was the one that was recalled. It was already given in this space, and I believe 33 people were affected. So knowing where we're giving these vaccines, and again, this is an indigenous community. We have to be mindful. Vaccines are not a good thing in some of these spaces. They were used as forms of sterilization. They were used as forms of other violence and medical violence in our community. So we're trying to still navigate a vaccine that's new, trying to navigate a pandemic with little to no healthcare access, and still maintain our resiliency in the modern identity through education, through healthcare, and through COVID, just the same as everywhere else. So understanding we're disproportionately, again, for to have a disproportionate community, you have to have had those proportions taken away. So understand where we need to have restorative justice in those spaces, and seeing where healthcare should be universal at this point. It really should. There should be free public transportation to these spaces, to communities that are already being harmed. And again, in communities like mine, that have issues of particulate pollution before there was ever COVID, understanding where we can have restorative justice in every sector and seeing where there has been predatory spaces, it has been more money to be poor than any. So knowing where these new sectors, whether energy or otherwise, are coming in, might again be predatory again and use these type of pandemics against Indigenous communities. We need to be mindful of going forward. And it's going to take a lot more of an equity analysis for disproportionate communities than just an economic analysis. And that is what we need to look at locally and nationally, no matter who the administration is at this point. Disproportionate communities need forms of equity analysis to honestly represent the moral spaces and the moral just protections that we need at this point, because we have already had this endangerment.
Thank you for that, Renee. I got a caller on the line. We're going to say hi to Jose, who's in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Thanks for giving us a ring, Jose. You're on air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the natives, they always suffer the most, and even before the pandemic. And there is a lot of things that are within their culture, you know, like sometimes a shaman would not let them get the help that they need. But most of the time, it's the government or other people that will take advantage of them. I would like to ask, what has been done to help some of these people? Some of them are doing really good, like the Kickapoo. They're able to come travel between Mexico and the USA, and I believe Canada. So they are doing good. Thank you very much.
All right, Jose, thank you for your call. And Renee, any thoughts for Jose?
Honestly, for Indigenous communities, I advocate for national healing remedies that you already have. For us here in Colorado, we have been having to use a lot of forms of fire cider, bear roots, which is Osha. Understanding your local medicines of cedar. When it comes to the vaccine, that's a personal choice. That's honestly, if you're going to use your body, you have to be mindful it is going to change your genetic RNA. So it is going to change your body. But understand if you have the ability to do that at this time, that's your own personal choice. If it's within your community that you take that within your elders, again, do value the words of your elders, but that is, again, your own personal choice. I would like to highlight how we should change, and I appreciate those on the call before, our diet. Understanding that food is medicine, and a lot of our medicines, even previously before this pandemic, we should be putting in a lot more of our diets and implementing on our daily without overusing or becoming a fad. It needs to be something that we use within seasonal, within regional spaces, and within our everyday diets to already build up our immunity for a lot of probably more pandemics like this, unfortunately. So really understanding your own local remedies and natural remedies, but most of all, understanding where access to Western medicine, if it can be beneficial to those that are strong enough to build that immunity and herd immunity locally, could have its benefits. And we need to also be mindful of that as well. It is a personal decision per your indigenous community and per your individual. So, of course, you're going to have your own cultural and spiritual influences to it as well. So, as always, do pray about it. But do be mindful that if that Western medicine can give you access to build that immunity and you're strong enough for future generations, hopefully it's able to do that as past ones have before, too. I've had to be vaccinated for other things because of the severity of where I live as well. So being mindful of that, but most of all, understanding your natural remedies and us living, again, within balance of those natural remedies regionally and otherwise, where we're not over-consuming them without being mindful to our earth.
All right. Thank you for that. And Jose, thank you for your call. We now go to Kat, who is in Isleta Pueblo, tuned in on KUNM here in New Mexico. Thanks for reaching out, Kat. You're on here.
Oh, morning, everybody. Hi, Tara. How are you doing?
Doing okay. Good to hear your voice,
That's
Kat.
That's good.
What are you thinking today?
Well, this is a whole uphill battle for all of us. We need to all get on the same page, all the indigenes across the whole earth. And mindful is a very key word. And I myself don't want to take the vaccine because of the genetic intrusion. But yet I see the rarity that we're in. So this really is one of the most difficult times we're all going to be going through. All I can say is I'm glad she's saying it's our own choice because, you know, I don't even know which way to go. We don't even really know what Wuhan is, how it got here, COVID, whatever this is. We really have to be strong. We have to investigate it. And all I can do is pray right now at this point because we are at a really, over the edge, the whole world. This is all about everybody included. But as far as them talking about people getting vaccines in Central, the natives there, I wish we could help them, but yet again, it's their choice. And where does, it's sad again, because when you look at this whole plandemonic, which is what I call it, it all comes down to economics, genetics, people like Bill Gates, Fauci. Think about it, people. Research this. And I'm praying for all of us.
We gotta look into things and get answers. Kat, good to hear your voice. Thanks for giving us a ring. There's still a little time left. You got to dial fast, 1-800-996-2848. Thanks for that. And Renee, what about in terms of testing for COVID-19? Have you been a part of that? And especially for people who have indigenous roots that are based in countries in Central or South America or even Mexico?
In Denver, we're a pretty large mixed population. We're the land of the Ute, Arapaho, Cheyenne, Lakota, Comanche, Kiowa, and 48 tribes that still travel through here, including Mexica. I myself am Dene Mexica, mixed Navajo and Mexicana. So in our spaces in Denver, it's a whole different, we could have a whole different mix of indigenous populations, mainly northern. And we've been able to offer COVID testing at our food shares, which we've been doing that about once or twice a week, and that gets back to you about every 2 to 3 days. And it's a quick test that tells you whether you tested and what you can do if you did test positive, things like that. For vaccines, we've been trying to maintain where we can for elders that want to, giving that information as quickly as we can on all our social media platforms. But again, it's such a personal decision whether you want to take that vaccine, because a lot of communities, because of that invisible identity of maintaining your resiliency, do have our other forms of healthcare or healthcare access too. And being mindful of that. But I myself cannot actually take the vaccine. I have a form of anemia. And as far as I've seen, it actually has a reaction to the vaccine. So I'm still going to be meeting with my doctor. And then my own personal cultural educators, if you will, and elders too, to truly kind of help me guide my decision. My children are under the age of 12. They cannot receive the vaccine. So being mindful of that in our communities of who can receive the vaccine, where you can receive the vaccine, and who your local communities are that are maintaining the COVID testing, which is normally those that hold social services in those spaces, and then where you can have the vaccine altogether. We try to go all together if that we see Denver Indian Health Center or Denver Indian Family and Resource Center has a vaccine clinic. We try to not reinvent the wheel, go support and advocate those that are already in the space holding that for our elders. And if there's BIPOC inclusively, then we try to do that as well. So we try to maintain it to where we can give that access to those that choose to. And it has been a whole mix of different Indigenous identity communities. But I really stress that you be mindful of how this vaccine is coming out in our communities, how it can affect, and those that are strong enough to take it again for herd immunity, and those that are not, how we can build those immunities with true resiliency from our own cultural self-determination.
Right. Thank you for that. Also here, too, is Oscar Chacon with Alianza Americas. And Oscar, any perspective on the vaccine and testing? Any thoughts in what you understand is going on with countries south of the U.S. border?
Well, the first thing to say is that, of course, people have a lot of questions regarding the vaccine, and in many ways, you know, the skepticism that many communities have, including, of course, Indigenous Afro descendants, but people in general, are reasonable questions. I mean, when you take into account the way in the past many of these communities have been treated, have been literally used, you know, for experiments that we now know more about. So people have reasons, you know, to be skeptical. I absolutely agree with the principle that in the end, I mean, it is a personal individual choice. But I think it is important to reconcile the wisdom of particularly Indigenous communities all over the world, you know, with whatever science can also provide us by way of helping us make the best choices possible. I can also tell you that it is true that most countries outside of the rich countries on the planet, because of the sad state of how profit-driven public health has become all over the world, that many of these countries don't really have access, you know, to enough vaccines, even if they wanted to vaccinate or if everybody wanted to get the vaccine. That is simply not necessarily something that is accessible. And, you know, patents have to do with it. The fact that technology capacity to produce something like a vaccine has been taken away from many countries over the past 15, 20 years. And we are seeing that also playing out in some ways, you know, in the U.S. with populations that are either just, you know, people that are immigrants from Latin America, but particularly when they happen to be indigenous populations. The last thing I want to say is language access continues to be a big challenge. You know, at Alianza Americas, we are actually conducting a national project supported by the Center for Disease Control to try to educate people about the vaccine, educate people about the importance of good practices, even in the time of a vaccine. And what we are finding is that it is absolutely crucial not just to use something like Google Translate to try to put things into other languages, but to really devote quality effort to produce good, accessible language content so that people can make the best choice for each of them.
Well, I appreciate your insight into this and everybody's insight who joined us today on the line, including Renee M. Chacon, Ruby Orozco Santos, and Oscar Chacon. And of course, thank you to our callers as well. Tomorrow, we hope you'll join us for another discussion. We're going to take on the issue of ecological grief. And if this is something that you are working directly with, We sure hope you'll make plans to join us and to call in and share your thoughts. Until then, if you'd like more information about our program, you can find it on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. I'm Tara Gatewood.
Support by the Sioux Trading Post, whose special selection of dried herbs are chosen for superior quality, and many sage, sweetgrass braids, and red willow bark and cedar are wild-crafted. All available at SiouxTrading.com. Wopila. Support by the Applied Indigenous Studies Department at Northern Arizona University, giving Native American students knowledge and tools to become change agents in their communities, where Indigenous knowledge is applied. nau.edu/native.
Skuktash cancer mumkita costa ubitma via pujerik ana hajakak toakik apadak mataboy mum omenyukut it amajut a mohanyi kokotamaki mamakai opachis machim ok healthcare.gov ok kumakogigik sikor sikor kuaik kumakogigik kok utas pumuk jut Idop Amjet Himak Centers for Medicare to Medicaid Hachipka.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis, Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.